This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 24th of November 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show...
This event goes beyond the frameworks of a regular fight against terrorism. Naturally, our military are pursuing a heroic battle against terrorism, sacrificing themselves and their lives. Today's loss for us was like a stab in the back delivered by the accomplices of terrorists.
As the Turkish military shoots down a Russian jet, our guests Robert Fox and Daniela Peled will tell us about the impact this will have on the fight against ISIS. And as Francois Hollande meets President Barack Obama in the White House, we continue on the topic of ISIS and assess if world leaders can be brought together. Also ahead, we look at the lockdown in Brussels and at worldwide travel alerts in the US and ask, is it paranoia or justified security? And finally in the programme, nation branding in Luxembourg. The country is set for a major image shift, but will it work? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, right now on Monocle 24. So welcome to Midori House, and my guests today are Robert Fox, the defence editor at the London Evening Standard, and Daniela Peled, editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Welcome both back to the programme. We start today's show with this top story. A Russian jet has been shot down by the Turkish military. Russian President Vladimir Putin was quick to react, describing it as a stab in the back carried out by accomplices of terrorists. Turkish military says that the jet was warned 10 times in 5 minutes before being shot down for allegedly violating Turkish airspace near the border with Syria. Robert, let's start with you. Something like this. So first of all, there's the question of whether it did actually cross into Turkish territory. But why do you think the Turks took this action? Because even if it did go through a small part of their airspace, it seems very unlikely that it was there in a hostile way against Turkey.
There's a lot behind this. I think there's a lot been going on. There's been a lot of bumping and shoving, and there's been a lot of incursions. They had a trouble only a day or so ago with a MiG-29 coming over. What they tend to do is to go out to sea and buzz the NATO fleets. There is a big dispute over oil and gas in the Eastern Mediterranean. Gas comes into this an awful lot. And what the Russians were worried about is apparently a group of Turkmen, and there is a tiny Turkmen minority in this area. By the way, it has been heatedly disputed since late Ottoman times, the Hatay, this tongue of land there. And if that isn't a problem, it's also the heartland of the al-Assad family and that strip of the Alawites. The Turkmen have been joined, so the Russians say, by dissident Turkmen from the Greater Russia Federation or the borders of, unspecified, who preach a new militancy. I hope I'm thoroughly confusing you, because it's a very, very muddled organization. One thing that must be said is that this didn't come out of the blue. They've had trouble before, and although they've discussed it, it's very interesting. Post-Warsaw Pact and post-NATO forces have no common IFF system, identification friend or foe, that works. And the Turks felt mightily provoked this time. It was an air-to-air shoot, and they gave warnings. But whoever was controlling ground control, higher levels of the Turkish Air Force, who on earth do they think it was coming at them? I mean, it wouldn't be the Iraqi Air Force, but wouldn't be the Iranian Air Force, and anyway, they would be allies. It's slightly bonkers, this whole thing.
And just before we bring in Daniel, just on this defence issue, you know, we've seen incursions in UK airspace on the perimeters of UK airspace, and on many of the Nordic countries the same. They tend to kind of like go and see each other, kind of eyeball each other, and then kind of move off. That seems to be enough. Do you think that somebody here just really kind of miscalculated? Because it's not that uncommon for this to happen. And on the whole, nations seem to kind of shrug their shoulders, don't like it, but kind of realise that to shoot would just be too dangerous. Do you think it's a technical error, a human error, or do you think they actually knew what was going to happen?
How would I know? Because what was going through their minds. But what the Sukhoi was doing, the Su-24, was quite clearly armed and was on a mission to do something. I don't think it was going to do a mission in Turkey, but I think it was going to do a mission on the Turkmen. And what this highlights, which we have to get into a bit later, the geopolitical tangle of this is, of course, how the Russians always suspect that the Turks see, that is the Erdogan regime, sees Bashar al-Assad as a bigger enemy than ISIS.
Daniel, let's bring you in here. And you know, we have seen in recent days a kind of grand coalition coming together where, you know, the French, the Russians, we're going to be looking at more of this in detail in a moment, but, you know, just the trips that Mr. Hollande has done in the last week and the people he'll have met within 1 week hints at, you know, all of these countries coming together. Do you think in the end that the Russians and perhaps even the Turks will have to kind of try and quickly come to some, you know, agreement over this, bury it, have some kind of, you know, investigation? Because in the end, neither of them wants it to particularly escalate. And they also do have a vision, you know, for peace in the region, even if they don't see the same person being in control.
Yeah, I don't think Turkey can really rely on a lot of support if it wants to ramp up actions against Russia, because you said we're reaching this very fragile, I think it's overstating even to call it a consensus, but people's positions and the actors' positions are not as far away from each other over Syria as they were even a few months ago. But there's a lot that Russia can do to get its to make its displeasure very keenly felt. I don't predict a massive military confrontation, because I don't think that's in anyone's interest. But I mean, obviously, predictably, Russians have cancelled a visit to Ankara.
There may be a trade embargo. They've told people not to go on holidays to Turkey. It's just as dangerous as Egypt.
They're
trying to ratchet up the economic element, first of all.
But that could have quite a serious effect. You know, there's a lot of Russian holiday makers in Turkey, so that's quite a serious move. Another thing the Russians can do, which would really annoy the Turks, is to increase their support for the various Kurdish parties. So that all these options are available for the Russians beyond, you know, any sort of military confrontation. But the language that Putin used today was extremely, extremely strong, talking of being stabbed in the back. Ideally, I think if Turkey could back down a bit, this could possibly avoid an awful lot of trouble. I mean, I agree with Robert that the decision to shoot it down, I think bonkers is probably the best analysis of it.
And we must just say, as we were coming on air, you know, very unconfirmed reports that are on Reuters saying that potentially both of the airmen may still be alive. That's what the Turkish authorities are saying, despite the images that we saw earlier today on websites that purported to show one of the parachutists killed and the whereabouts of the other unknown. Robert, that would slightly change the narrative a little bit if both of the airmen were still alive, do you think?
Yeah, and treated well. I think that's what they got to hope for, because as Daniela was saying, the tendency is always to ratchet up. It's be a good thing if some of these people on the ground tended to ratchet down, which they've got to if they're ever going to have peace. But nobody's really thinking of peace at the moment. But the point between Russia and Turkey is this: they've both got each other over a barrel, as it were, over gas. Russia needs to sell the gas. Turkey needs to buy the gas. And that's the thing that Putin and Lavrov particularly know. Yeah, they can have a bit of shoulder shaking and stalking off at the moment, but they're locked in it together. But and also what Daniela was saying, absolutely right. The regional terms in which the Turks, particularly the Erdogan government, see it, you hardly get a whiff of it over here. They do see the PKK and the popular YPG groups as almost a bigger an enemy as ISIS, because they say, look, we've been at war with these people. This is the way they see it for 30 years. And, you know, how many tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands of casualties all told in a third of a century.
And there has been some claims from the Russians today that the Turks took this action because they're trying to defend actually the illegal oil trade coming across their border, that they're beneficiaries of the ISIS, trade.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
Now, just on the question that I was bringing Daniela in there on this notion of the Grand Coalition, for either of you, what's interesting here in the UK and in many of the other capitals, we're seeing this debate, you know, should we be joining this coalition? You know, should the UK be sending military? It looks like there'll be a vote in the next few days. You see an incident like this, and suddenly the pacifists, that those on the mainly on the far left who are really opposed to getting involved, they've got a good argument suddenly, haven't they?
Well, they've been talking about it soon, the beginning of the airstrikes.
I think that's a no from Mr. Fox, but we'll come back to him in a second.
It's the image of Corbyn in Parliament yesterday.
We possibly agree a little bit on this as well. But, I mean, this was a danger that was highlighted at the beginning of the airstrike. Something like this would be... I think the danger was more in the realm of friendly fire than this. But there isn't enough coordination. And I think... What Hollande is talking about, and we'll talk about this as well, is more of a unified strategy, rather than what we have at the moment, where various actors with their own interests are kind of vaguely coalescing around a plan.
Now, we don't want to slip in too much to UK politics, Robert, but I take it from your snort that you're not a fan of Mr. Corbyn's grasp of military matters.
No, the point that I was making with that snort was this extraordinarily isolated figure that he cut when he was supposed to be replying to the government's new defence review and national security strategy. He was deserted by his front bench. I mean, just to recall to the listeners, I don't know whether they've seen the images, he was alone. There was a sea of empty green benches around him. And this is supposed to be an opposition in a vibrant democracy, which depends on a vibrant opposition. And that's the problem. Well, we will park that, because actually, I'm not going to let Mr. Cameron get away with it either. British policies trying to follow up with Hollande now are still more gestural than practical. That they've said, yes, we must do this, and yes, we must do that. And it is worth just looking at the British instance at the moment, because this week we had the very important Strategic Defence and Security Review. Golly, the why and wherefore, the context in which we're working, it was so thin. Migration, refugees, this huge crisis, 6 lines. They don't really know, poor things, what to do. Interestingly, for the alliance, the UK is about to stand up a rapid intervention brigade. And I think it's because the sharp guys who have not shot their mouths off have told Cameron, if you're serious about closing this down, there will have to be, in one form or another, to help the local forces on the ground, a ground presence. That is the thing that is staring them in the face. And they don't want to do it. They don't know how to sell it to their people. But they know it's the only way you can make a military plan, a military policy. Forget about fancy words like strategy. There is nothing coherent about this, because is Hollande going to appoint an allied supreme commander, which is what you would need to do? Is Obama going to call back people he sacked, Petraeus and McChrystal, who are the only people with the capability of doing this?
I think we should probably push the conversation in that. It's a very good point, Robert, because President Hollande is in Washington today for a series of talks with Barack Obama, as he's been continuing his meetings with other world leaders to forge a stronger international alliance against ISIS. However, the talks may be complicated by what we've just been discussing. And we should just look at the diary of President Hollande this week. On Monday, he met Prime Minister David Cameron, who was in Paris. Tuesday, he's gone to see Obama. On Wednesday, Angela Merkel will be coming by Paris. Thursday, he is going to be meeting Mr. Putin. And on Sunday, he will be meeting the Chinese president as well. So an extraordinary diary, Dania. And then we're talking about this coalition. Oddly, France is probably, even today in the criticism we've seen by Russia of the allies and the Turks, Russia kind of pointedly saying, apart from France, Hollande, the mouse that roared. He's the man of the moment, isn't
he? The marshmallow that roared. Yeah, I mean, he really has transformed himself in a week, and his popularity was pretty poor before, but it's soared. I think he was left with very little choice. I mean, parallels have been drawn to what George W. Bush, how he responded after 9/11, which I think is a little unfair, but certainly the tables have been turned completely.
Oh, I mean, Mr. Chirac was like, please, please, like, we're not going to do anything. This isn't the time to get involved.
Exactly. And now we have French leader in Washington saying exactly the opposite message. No talk of cheese eating surrender monkeys here. But he's got a hard task ahead of him. I mean, he's willing to get involved, but at the same time, the French are not battle weary in the same way that the British say or the Americans are, because they haven't had that that same involvement. And it's true that ground forces will be needed. There's a limit to what you can do with a bombing campaign, even the way that the coalition has been doing it so far and liaising with allied forces, you know, forces on the ground, the local forces. Militarily, and I'm not saying it's a simple matter to go and wipe out ISIS, because it never is simple to wipe out an insurgent force like this, but could they be containable? I mean, all the analysis I've read have indicated that, yes, there is a lot that can be done, but the countries involved will need to be prepared to take their own losses and will need to actually get involved in a much more, well, literally boots on the ground way.
Robert, while we're unpacking tricky issues, here's an equally tricky one. So the Brits aren't very keen to put boots on the ground for very obvious reasons. As Daniela correctly says, this is battle weariness. Go to Washington, D.C. You know, we think the Brits may not have a plan. The Americans certainly don't seem to have a plan either, and a real reluctance to put, you know, troops on the ground when you potentially have, you know, Russians there, Turks there, Assad forces. That really isn't going to happen. So when Hollande goes to see Obama, apart from getting, you know, a bit of nod and agreement, as happened when he met Putin, you know, what do you think the Americans will be willing to do?
Not that much. They'll talk a lot of intelligence. They'll talk about how we need to ramp up sharing of intelligence. They're always very reluctant with the French. They'll do it with the Brits. They almost prefer to do it with the Germans than with the French. It was a very, very bad history, particularly in the Balkans in the 1990s. Obama looks absolutely like the rabbit caught in the headlights. It's been a dreadful week for him. His performance has been less than convincing, because he knows his allies are telling him there's got to be some kind of military commitment there. And he was the man who was against military commitment. It's his going out. He is going out with a whimper rather than a bang. And people like Cameron and Merkel and Renzi, and as well as, of course, Hollande, are very, very worried about this, because you need America capacity literally for heavy lifting, for logistics and for planning and for surveillance and targeting. And that they are so reluctant that this is the American pretense, and this is sort of almost a psychological displacement because of fracking, is that all this messy Middle East situation, it's a European problem. It's Europe's doorstep. So I think there's that going on. There's another thing, though, which is a product of Afghanistan as well as Iraq, is they haven't a clue how to plan for phase four. The political, social, economic plan to restore confidence to this area, which really is out of control. What the Brits will do is that they will take a minimalist approach, which will be shared with the French, to support natural allies. The French have had a historic interest there for over a century and a half. The British have guarantees, proper guarantees, to a country like Jordan, and one or two bilateral agreements in the Gulf, park that. But it's Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey that they are most worried about. And the British do have a lot of influence in the Kurdish entity, and they will have to stick with that. But Cameron is, it's very interesting, in their bombastic rhetoric, Bush and Blair went together, and Cameron is very similar to Obama. Actually, although he does the Flash Harry number and appears in front of the cameras very, very effectively, You read the document, you read his introduction to the Defence Review and the National Security Strategy, he's not there. As I wrote in my column today, it's like the old late 19th century headline, Fog in the Channel, English Channel, continent cut off. He is an absolute isolationist, and this is a very big problem. And his whole mental conspectus and those of his cabinet round him is isolationist towards the troubles of the Inner Sea, the whole Mediterranean basin, which is a hot area now, as well as the Middle East and the Levant.
Well, we could unpack that, because I'm sure that some of that has to do with, you know, the EU vote coming up as well.
He
really doesn't want to, it's seen to be got caught up. We're going to have to take a short break. There's so much more to pack into the show. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, Robert Fox and Daniela Peled.
For our next Monocle Property Prospectus film, we head to Zurich's Kreisfehr. Once a red light district, its maverick and vibrant character now inspired designers and entrepreneurs to move into the neighbourhood.
You have this grand mix of everything, and you always see some crazy things or some inspiring things. And even though it's not the most sane commercial decision, it was just clear, this is the vibe. And obviously the benefit is because it's exciting, it's also changing.
Zurich's unexpected new hood, Kreisfehr, is now playing in the film's menu on monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. I'm Andrew Tuck, and still with me are my guests for today, Robert Fox and Daniela Peled. Now, Europe and the world is on edge following the tragic events in Paris, but as Brussels enters a fourth day of maximum security and the United States issues a worldwide travel alert until February next year, some start to question whether the measures are too dramatic or are actually justified. Daniela, too dramatic?
I'm not sure there's any question that it's too dramatic. I mean, obviously, I haven't been privileged with any and on iota of the intelligence involved, but the reaction has been so incredibly extreme. The mayor of Brussels has been making political capital out of it, as well he might, because the city has been shut down. To coin a complete cliche, this is the perfect way for the terrorists to win. So I understand that the government has to walk a line between protecting its citizens, because citizens expect to be protected from political violence. But it's an enormous overreaction. I can't believe that the threat posed, we haven't even been clear about the threat, is worth destroying the life of the city for its tourism. I think our governments also need to do.
But a terrible bind, though. If you're sitting in City Hall and you have been given advice by the police, potentially a bomb could go off in somewhere which is packed with tourists. Do you do nothing? Carry on with your business?
Yeah. You know, so closing the schools, though.
Either way, they're a
the
loser.
Metro. Yeah. Either way, there's a metro. But this is something. This is a danger that's not going to go away. And I think the reaction from in Paris as well, immediately after a terror attack, what the citizens of a country need to feel that, no, we will carry on, our life will go on, we'll beat them, we'll stand together. And this is what, in Brussels, they've kind of given up before the attack has even happened. I think governments really have to make the point to citizens that, yes, there is a danger of violence, and yes, we have to be alert, but actually the real risk of being injured or killed in terrorism is infinitesimal.
Robert, do you think the reactions too? Because what's intriguing is that, you know, when we had the bomb attacks here in London, there was, you know, two that came in quick succession, and on the first one, I think people were a bit stoical afterwards. It was terrible, but you kind of went back around your business. But when there was a second potential attack, then suddenly people were like, oh God, could this be like every week? Is this a new normal? And there were, I think there was more disquiet because that now Brussels is in that kind of situation. It's seen the Paris attack. It knows there's been all these raids. And it also looks at its city and knows that seemingly the most wanted man in the world at the moment seems to have been able to kind of slip around the city and dodge the police with a reasonable amount of ease.
Well, I don't even know if he's there.
If he's there, I'm sure he's laughing.
But this is very difficult because everything that's been said so far around this table is pure conjecture. What is it that they don't know? What is it that they're worried about? I've talked to several people who are very fed up with the situation in Brussels, and they're used to this kind of stuff with the IRA and terrorism, with Red Brigades and so on. I think we have to refer to Tokyo, March 20th, 1995. And I think that they're worried that they're going to do something a little bit different, possibly with sarin, ricin, something like that. Then you're in a whole new ball game. And that's why the Belgian forces, I don't know how long the security forces can keep this up, but it's why you close the metro. It's why you close schools to an extent, why you close places of public gathering. There's something in the intelligence that is telling them that they've missed. They've got a heck of a problem with ISIS, because ISIS, as we've always said here, operates on three or four levels, the cyber level, the practical stuff on the ground. What we're looking at now is an operation. It doesn't matter whether it's in the Middle East or not. Every other day we get a new Mr. Big, and the current Mr. Big is Abu Mohammed Adnani, who is technically extremely capable. By the way, there are things that are kind of spooky about all this. The explosive used in the suicide vests in Paris was exactly the same. A very interesting hybrid of domestic products that was used in the underground attacks in London, allegedly put together by an Egyptian doctor who then mysteriously disappeared. To cut to the chase, what has happened is, it seems to me, ISIS Terror Inc. has metastasized, as in cancer. It is spread. It has gone away. And I'll bet there's a bit of a good sort of branch general headquarters running new operations out of Morocco at the moment. It's absolutely clear. It is that it is so unknown. And this is being compounded by the fact that they're hauling in suspects, turning them over, and finding nothing. So that they think there's a lot out there. And what the subtext is that they say, we allowed Molenbeek to really get completely out of control as little Morocco, and we don't really know what to do about it. They can't take a suburb of 250,000 apart.
And you can't change, you know, years and years of not building community relations.
That's right. No, and that's where we are.
We're going to cross the border slightly for a slight change of tone to end the show. And apologies, Daniel. I know that Daniel had many more points to bring in there. So Little Luxembourg is going to try and do a bit of a rebrand. It got caught up with a bit of the financial, well, skullduggery, and it feels its reputation has been tarnished somewhat. So it's kind of gone out to the people, it's done a bit of a survey, and it's come back with, you know, the people think it's actually rather a nice, reliable place, and it's going to go out there and try and give itself a new reputation. Daniela, when you look at Luxembourg, do you think it has any kind of selling points that it should be kind of playing up? Apparently sausages are going to play a key role in its new brand.
Well, I was thinking about this, given the current crisis over refugees in Europe, you could call itself Luxembourg, the home of Schengen.
Yeah,
that's where the agreement was signed.
Luxembourg, yeah. The home of Schengen. It doesn't quite have the ring for like the tourist, though, does it?
Luxembourg, the home of the sausage. There's not very much
well,
you can do.
I think
with
it may pull in more people than you imagine.
Luxembourg, where your money comes out ever more cleaner.
Yes, that's one of the things. Now, the other thing is that they're pointing out that some of the other countries that have attempted to do this, Ukraine went for a nice catchphrase. Ukraine for you. You see, they were using you. Slovenia, where they highlight the word love in Slovenia. So, you know, they're all having a go at it. But what's interesting is, can you change people's perception of a country with a little bit of PR? And that seems the bit that seems more complicated to do. Simon Anholt is one of these people who does a lot of nation branding stuff, has said that he feels it's impossible to kind of change the task. Do you think you can change it with a bit of PR?
Well, I think you have to have a very, very concerted strategy. I mean, I've lost count of the number of jollies that I've been offered to go to places like Azerbaijan and so on. Well, we'll see a different side of the country, and you'll enjoy the local cuisine, and never mind all the human rights issues. So I think you have to focus on, I think food is a good place to start, really. If you think of Swiss cheese, Swiss chocolate, you don't necessarily think of the Swiss banking system.
No, I think, and the Swiss, they're very lucky. They have a good flag, which I think is good for branding. And they still have kind of stuck to these principles of kind of neutrality, which, you know, maybe it's by hosting other people, but it does kind of rub off on their national brand a little bit.
William Tell, the symbol of abuser of juvenile rights. Come on, you know. I don't think you can sort of change these things. It happens. Actually, I think what Luxembourg really needs to do, because they've actually, as you rightly say, they've made a tremendous onslaught, propaganda onslaught. They just need to get over themselves and lighten up a bit. But I don't know how you tell a Luxembourger to lighten up a bit.
Well, they should accept that they're kind of the place for kind of rich people. They should be like luxury Luxembourg.
Yeah, that's the other option.
Or maybe a new beef burger, luxury burger. So, yeah, we've sorted it all out for them. Get rid of the sausage, go for the burgers. We are really, really going to have to leave it there. My thanks to Robert Fox and Daniela Pellid for joining me here on Midori House today. Today's show, it was produced by Carlotta Rabello, and it was researched by Fernando Agosto Pacheco and also by Pierce Ellison. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Chris Chilvers will be here, bringing you lots of music from our international playlist. Then at 1900 hours, it's Section D with Henry Reece Sheridan. And at 2200 hours, it's Monocle Daily. But from me, Andrew Tuck, just time to say goodbye.